Welcome to the Film Rescue Show. We're lending a helping hand to Hollywood in fixing their feature films, flub-ups, faux pas, and maybe framing them for tax evasion, hypothetically.
Allegedly.
Today, I'm joined by all of our hosts. We have Brandon, Aaron, and Jesse. Say hello to the wonderful people listening.
Hello to the wonderful people listening.
And stole my joke.
Hello.
Be quicker next time.
Today, we are discussing one from the naughty list. We're racking them off of there to finish out the season. We're talking about 2020's infamous Doolittle.
Is it infamous?
Yes.
It's going to be after this one.
Yikesy dicey.
This was directed by Stephen Gagan? I guess I should have looked that up earlier.
Yeah,
I don't... He's not known for a lot yet, and... We'll get into some alleged theories later on as to why anyone is in this movie.
He wrote and directed Syriana?
Yeah.
Holy God, this guy's great. What? Oh.
Yes.
Continue.
So I in a sentence or less, I would like everyone to give their thoughts, their first impression. Because none of us had seen this until this week, right? We were all brand new to this movie.
Yep.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
All right, guys. One sentence or less. What'd you think?
There was no good part about this film that wasn't stolen almost entirely from another film.
Mm-hmm. Brandon?
Yeah, I mean, this is just one of those films that's kind of just a movie that you can see a lot of money went into and went to the... theaters, nobody saw it, and just disappeared after that. I'm indifferent to it. It exists. I've seen worse, and I've seen far better.
What's the phrase you like to use? Non-movie?
Yeah, non-movie.
Yeah.
Although some others are definitely more non-movie-ish than this. Like, I can at least see what they were kind of trying with this, and just not ticking any of the boxes in the process. But there are some where some movies I can just watch. I just feel like they just cave in on themselves, like The Mummy. That's one of the best. The 2017 Mummy, I feel like that's one of the best examples off the top of my head. But, you know, to be fair, like if I had to rewatch this or the 2017 Mummy, I actually would rather rewatch this because at least this has a smidge more personality to it than The Mummy did. But that's not saying much.
Interesting.
Yes.
So I want to. Obviously, I want to start with positives, but actually, I want to just go down the list of absolute insane star power that is this film. So, like we just said a minute ago, Stephen Gagan, incredible director when he's working on his own stuff. The score was done by Danny Elfman, and he can do this shit in his sleep at this point. But
yeah.
So good. The cinematographer is Guillermo del Toro's like go-to guy, Guillermo Navarro. He has shot basically all of Guillermo del Toro's films. I mean, you got Pan's Labyrinth, Hellboy movies, Pacific Rim. The man has a just laundry list of great things. He worked with Robert Rodriguez. Just an amazing cinematographer. The cast is. Anyone that has ever been famous in the last 10 years, just running down the list, this is insane. I cannot believe Robert Downey Jr., Harry Collette, Antonio Banderas, Michael Sheen, Jim Broadbent, Jesse Buckley. Let me skip down to some of the voices. Emma Thompson, Rami Malek, John Cena, Camille Nanciani, Octavia Spencer, Tom Holland, Craig Robinson, Ralph Fiennes, Selena Gomez, Marion Cotillard.
Whenever films are like this, that they kind of know the movie isn't good, what they will do is they will pack it full of stars to sort of get an audience into the theater. It's called star packing. They will load a movie up with a bunch of big names. So it's like, oh, yeah, I like that person. I like that person. I'll go see that. And they base it upon your knowledge of their previous work to get you into the theater.
Yeah.
Yes.
Like Robert Downey Jr. and Tom Holland, they work together on, you know, all the Marvel movies. Oh, this will be great. And they have no scenes together.
Right.
Yeah.
But enough about movie 43.
Yes.
Oh. I would. Okay, for everybody out there wondering, no. No, we're never going to touch that.
There's nothing to fix.
That's completely different. That's a completely different ball game.
Yeah, that's in the no-no list with The Room and movies of that kind.
When ads for that movie were showing up on Pornhub, I was like, "What?
Wow."
You have
wow,
the
bar
for
is
Pornhub?
Low.
I have those blocks.
My reason for wanting to list all of this talent was to make the positive section harder.
We can't pull from that as a positive.
Unless there's someone here that's like you're a god to you, and you're just that was the one oasis in this desert of a film. Unless that's the case, yeah, try to avoid cast and crew, specifically something on the screen that you enjoyed. Let's start with Aaron.
Costumes.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah, the costumes are pretty nice. That was one of the... I liked the character Lady Mary. In fairness, I only watched the first half of the movie because I did not like it and did not feel like suffering through it. So,
it was Aaron.
Yeah.
This is Aaron's pitch, and she bailed halfway through this movie.
Let's just put it this way. All of these actors and actresses, they got to put in their names in them without having to have those actors do any work or anything. So I'm going to do this pitch without having to suffer through the movie. It only seems fair, my friends.
I love it. Costumes were good. I wish I could say hair and makeup was good, but
it wasn't.
Oh, it's been a long time since I've seen like foundation lines like mm-hmm. that strong on an actor, but specifically the beginning of the movie, Robert Downey Jr.
Oh, I have something that's kind of a legitimate one. If lighting wasn't a part of cinematography and the CGI wasn't there, the cinematography would have been good. Unfortunately, the lighting is and so is the CGI, so any good cinematography they might have had was completely lost, but they tried.
It feels like a movie, it's kind of comparable to Justice League in that they cranked up the brightness in post.
Yeah.
It really looks a lot like that, because I think this was meant to look much more naturalistic, but then you look at the lighting and it's like, oh my god, it's so bright all the time. Even at night. The night scenes are like, they look like day for night shooting.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and you can tell almost all of this was like green screen sets.
Oh,
like,
yeah, this is all sets.
I bet the storyboards for this looked really incredible.
Oh, sure. Well, I mean, the artwork for the old books is, I mean, classic stuff. Just, you know, Google the old books, and even just the art on the covers is amazing. Brandon, a positive on your watch of Doolittle 2020.
Yes, so without cast taken into account, I actually like the... the opening animated cel-shaded sequence.
Oh, yeah.
I would not have hated it if the whole movie were like that. I would have been okay with that. If you do cel-shading right to give it like that sort of hand-drawn feel but still making it look a little different, it's fine, especially if you get the frame rate right. Because I think when there's cel-shading to give that 2D look, if they don't get the frame rate right, it looks too CG. But sometimes if you do like that halved frame rate, it makes it look more like standard animation while still giving it sort of like a pop-up book feel at the same time, depending upon how you do your angles. And I think that might have been what they were going for, like a pop-up fairy tale book. And I wouldn't have hated it if the whole movie were like that. At least it would have had more of an excuse for all of Robert Downey Jr.'s lines being dubbed. We'll get to that later.
We definitely will get to that. Jesse, reach deep into the depths and pull out another positive.
Oh, you left me at the last one. Oh, man. I like the opening animation, and I like the ending credits. And that's it. That's all I got. I have not had a worse time watching a movie this year. We have suffered through so much, and I really think this is the worst thing we've watched this far on the show. I would gladly rewatch Serenity before watching this crap again.
Here's the problem with a movie like this. If you have a movie like this that constantly references other movies and it's this mediocre, you're going to do what I did, and as soon as Don Carpenterian or whoever the fuck that ant motherfucking mafia oso was, you're going to be like, you know what, I'm just going to watch Godfather and actually enjoy myself for the next 3 hours.
The problem with that is if most of your humor is aimed towards kids, if you make a Godfather reference, they ain't going to get that.
Yeah, that was...
So that's part of the problem.
That's the thing, though. Any kid watching this movie will understand the reference because of Zootopia, so they're going to think they're referencing Zootopia. Oh, I'm not kidding. Oh,
God, stop making me feel old, Seth!
How do you think I feel?
I'm older than you,
I'm the third oldest
dumbass.
Of the four of us.
I'm older than you.
I know.
I do have a positive, or I guess kind of a scattershot positive.
Whatever that means.
there are little shining nuggets throughout this movie of what the good movie version of this would have been.
Yeah.
So for instance, there's a sequence where they have a tuba hooked up to a speaker system in their boat that calls whales in to help, and then they have a whale harness to speed
cool.
their boat up. Hey, in a better movie, I would have been like, this is like fun kid action adventure. Like, they're not, you know, gonna break any records or anything like that, but I'm here for a fun action adventure movie.
Do you know what idea I had? A James Bond villain that uses the whale harness.
Oh, yeah.
That's totally villain energy. That's totally villain energy.
I mean, we've already got the voice of Rami Malek, so.
Yeah.
Perfect.
If that movie ever comes out.
And then when they get to Antonio Banderas' island, you could tell that they cut, like, a large chunk of that scene where, because he's in a disguise for no reason. They don't interact with anybody. Because I'm pretty sure they cut out a bunch of stuff where they made their way up to the castle. And that's the kind of stuff that I would have been able to give, like, a, you know, an actual positive to. Again, this is probably one of the poorest made movies we've watched this year. We'll get into why, but yeah, the action adventure stuff was competent and engaging. There was no reason, like, scene to scene for the things to happen beyond people saying things either, you know, off screen or narration popping in at random points to tell you what's happening. But in a vacuum, the action stuff felt fun and creative. So that's my positive.
Okay.
that's all I can really give it. Now let's talk about what went wrong.
Jesus Christ, why is the CGI so fucking ugly? How do you fuck it up that bad?
Because it's all lit for day.
It's so bad.
Yeah, it's the same problem as Pacific Rim Uprising, where everything is lit for daylight, but it never looks quite right because it's all a green screen and all the actual practical elements don't fit.
Mm-mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is clearly something that would have... I go back and watch, like, the Eddie Murphy Dr. Dolittle film.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, they have the horrible mouth-moving thing on the actual animals, but at least they had actual animals.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I will give them credit there. Yeah, and I don't hate that first movie. I mean, I haven't seen any of the sequels.
And
but...
I mean, here's the problem. While this film comes out, you also have a certain Disney film about a certain lion that's just, you know, tinkering around as well. And you know what? For better or for worse, those lions look like goddamn lions.
Yeah.
That's true.
I mean, we can go into all the problems with all the Disney remake movies, but at least they actually look competent.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's Disney money, not Universal money.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. How much did this movie lose at the box office?
It actually didn't. It actually made, I won't say it made a profit because I'm sure, like, with advertising costs, but it was 175 mil to make and it brought in 250.
Mm.
So it made back its production budget, but it probably lost money on advertising.
Yeah.
I would not doubt it. But that was probably by design, and I will push that off until we get past the negatives of the film itself.
Yeah.
Guys, if you had to guess, how much of Robert Downey Jr.'s audio was ADR?
85%.
95%.
All.
No, there's one or two lines.
There's
that
a couple of lines.
It's like Where's Waldo, though. If you can actually find it, I want to hear. Because I was trying to multitask and, like, get a workout in and watch the rest of this film. And so at that point, I actually had it in my headphones. I'm thinking, why does his stuff sound more recorded in post than the animal voices? Yeah. Like, there were times you could hear, like, the reverb of the recording studio. I'm like, are you fucking kidding me?
I didn't actually know if Robert Downey Jr. was voicing Robert Downey Jr. in this film, so I Googled it, because I was really not quite... I was like, maybe he couldn't do the accent, so they brought in, like, a RDJ impersonator to do the accent, who still did the accent badly.
What's hilarious about that is, what's I think it was in... I haven't even played it, but I saw a run-through on YouTube. But apparently in Marvel vs. Capcom Infinite, they actually have someone doing a blatant RDJ for Iron Man, even though that's not based on the MCU. So I'm sitting there thinking, like, wait, why would they get art? No, it's an impression. Got it. But in this case, like, no, that's him. I think that he was trying to do a voice on set. He wasn't happy with it, so he tried it again in post. And what's funny is I actually read that he said that... Even in an interview, said that he was doing a quote-unquote passable accent. So even then, I think he was already being... I think he was aware that his accent that he picked for this one just wasn't good. Because as Holmes, as Sherlock Holmes, it was fine. His accent's fine in those movies. It's movie English accent, for lack of a better term. This, it was like, okay, I'm
trying to do Welsh for one.
But I'm getting traces of like Billy Connolly and a little Mrs. Doubtfire. I'm like, what even is this voice?
Yeah.
Bad.
And I said, if you're going to have a guy with a Welsh accent, hire a Welsh actor. Yeah. And then I remembered, oh, right, Robert Downey Jr. is not only the actor in this film, he also assisted with the scripts, produced the film with his wife, and it's his production company. So he basically got himself multiple paychecks.
Yep.
We'll push that towards the end of this negative section.
Yeah. But then, the voice notwithstanding, where... For the love of God, what was his character? He was like three different things, and two of them were two different versions of Jack Sparrow.
I feel like this is a sequel to the 1967 film. I feel like that's what it is. I don't think this is meant to be a remake. I think it's meant to be a sequel.
But that's the thing, like when you do attempt a soft reboot like that, you can't do it, you know, decades after the fact with new actors and new everything and treat it like the first film and then leave people in the dark. Because I was reading that this was apparently the first non-20th Century Fox Dr. Doolittle film, because they did the original years ago and then they did the Eddie Murphy ones in the 90s. So this was Universal's first attempt with the franchise. What's hilarious is that if it actually stayed with Fox, this would have ended up being a Disney movie.
True.
So it's like, pick your poison at this point. So
I could honestly see this as a Disney movie, because then they can have some quality control.
Yeah, no, this it really does feel like Universal trying to do Disney.
Yeah. Well, it's like they're trying to do the Lone Ranger Disney and not, you know, and for this to be a punch up to that level, that's bad, guys. That's bad.
But I mean, we've already mentioned Jack Sparrow. I feel like he was mixing Jack Sparrow and his turn of Sherlock Holmes and just made this amalgamation of the two into his interpretation, basically, of Doolittle.
Yeah.
I mentioned off air that this is we like to refer to these as movie blenders. It's a multitude of various films that have sort of been cobbled together. It's Pirates of the Caribbean. It's The Lone Ranger. It's Pixar's Up. It's there's a whole assembly of things that I wrote out last night, but it's basically like 10 separate movies slammed together that don't really mesh very well. Throw them in a blender and you just get this horrible concoction at the very end.
Yeah, with just the most meandering plot, I think.
When you really break it down, the plot is simple. Go here, get the thing, go back.
It's the
simplest plot, but there's like 10 million divergences.
Yeah, yeah, it's just MacGuffin.
Yeah.
All right, Aaron, negatives, more negatives. You weren't having a good time
I
for
did
the
not
half
like
that you watched.
Movie. You know, I think part of it is... I am a giant fucking nerd about things like history, and one of my obsessions is like Victorian era, like England and nerdery alongside of that. So the whole plot just falls flat if you know anything about the history of royalty. So at this point in time, Victoria is very young. And she doesn't have any heirs or anything like that. She hasn't done anything of any importance. They don't even really respect her as a queen yet, because she's still a child queen or whatever. It we're not given a reason to care about her, so we don't really... I mean, like, oh, yeah, Queen Victoria dies. Oh, man, that's so sad. But, like, for the universe, it's not, like, the hugest of consequences. And the other consequence is that, okay, if Queen Victoria dies, then Dr. Doolittle loses his property that he doesn't actually seem to be actively doing anything with at the moment anyway. So does he really deserve that property? He's a giant fucking asshole. So, like, there's the whole crux of that problem, okay? And then there's the whole crux of the problem with just his the loss of his land, where you don't make contracts with a child monarch. You make contracts with the crown. The contracts transfer with the crown. Whoever the frick got the crown after her would be the new contract holder. Yeah, you'd have a different landlord. They might choose to foreclose on you because you're a stupid son of a bitch. But you're a stupid son of a bitch. So who the hell cares? Okay, what are you doing? You're keeping a polar bear alive in the middle of England? Do you want a cookie for that? Like, fucking put the polar bear back in the Antarctic where it belongs. Give the land to people who fucking deserve it. And maybe that's a movie that I care about. I don't know. I could not care less about the plot. I could not find the plot less believable. Don't put real characters in real situations in a plot that's just fantasy thumb up my ass.
Right. I was literally waiting for magic to become part of it. And
yeah.
Also, Nightshade kills people quickly. Pick a fucking different poison or a fake poison. What are you doing? Anybody that knows anything about, like, they're going to be like, Nightshade, doesn't that, like, kill you fast? Like, why is she still alive? Like, if she's slowly dying from Nightshade, it's because a small dose is being administered over time and just getting rid of all the people making her food and all of the assholes around her. Just get rid of all the white men around her and probably the problem will be better, much like any other problem in society.
Oh, can I point something out? There's
sure.
There's a guy on Michael Sheen's ship, and he's black, and he's in command of, like, the vessel. Anybody else find that a little odd?
Did they, yes, very.
I'm just pointing it out that it's like, it reminds me a little bit of that movie Overlord, where their commanding officer is a black guy, and I'm like, I'm not opposed to that, it's just that it's not accurate at all to history.
Yeah, although that movie is fantastic.
I love the movie, but yeah, it's just one thing where I'm just like, huh?
Wolfenstein, the movie.
Wolfenstein, the movie, yeah.
So I had a big complaint that I brought up while we were watching this last night in the Discord. Links are in the description of this podcast if you'd like to join us on Friday nights. I was talking about how the boy, what was it, Stubbins? Oh my God! First of all, what a goddamn fucking terrible. Hey, do you want to prove someone's British? Call them Stubbins.
That kid look a lot like the kid from Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, the remake?
Oh, very, very similar to what's
that?
Yeah,
there's another movie that you can throw
Freddie Highmore.
It feels like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
You're just naming Johnny Depp movies.
Yeah, not the original, but the remake, the terrible remake, also scored by Danny Elfman.
Yep. So he's learning the language of the animals.
How?
And yeah, so another movie did this way better in, like, way less time, called The 13th Warrior. Have you guys ever seen that?
Oh yeah, yeah, John McTiernan.
So
also starring Antonio Banderas.
Antonio Banderas, yep. So he plays a guy who gets teamed up with Vikings, essentially, and
he's
doesn't
like a missionary, right?
Yeah, and he doesn't speak their language, but they're on this, like, really, really long trek to get to this faraway place. And so over the course of what's basically a montage, you hear them, like, talking in another language, but then English starts to get sprinkled in for the audience to understand that he's starting to get the language. And then by the end of this journey, he's now able to, like, speak and converse with them, and now all the characters who before were, like, subtitled speaking a foreign language are now speaking English to show that now our main character understands them.
Yeah, I like that device a lot.
Why not do that for this?
Warrior on Cinemax is something similar where the Chinese-speaking characters can understand each other. However, rather than doing subtitles, whenever they're speaking to each other, we hear them speaking English, but then when they speak to somebody else, it's either broken English or strictly Mandarin to make it seem like, okay, so what we're hearing is how they understand each other, but it's kind of just being quote-unquote translated.
Right.
So that's the irony, is that these actors can speak fluent English, but when they speak to the characters who actually can speak English, suddenly it sounds like broken English, so they're being understood intentionally.
Right.
So it's pretty surreal. Like, I think it was one of the first episodes that really like did sort of a camera trick to imply, okay, we're going to switch over, so now we can understand them as if they're speaking to each other. And it was an interesting way to kind of do a loophole, especially since not all the cast was actually Chinese. Like, they actually had, I think the star of the show is actually Japanese, and one of the primary actors is Indonesian, but they do like phonetically speak. I think they jump back and forth between Cantonese and Mandarin depending upon where the characters are based from. But yeah, like a lot of movies don't really do that. You know, they always have their other circumventing ways, if you will.
Well, because what happens is it leads to problems later on in the movie where the kid doesn't understand animals yet, but he's still talking to them. Like Jason Mantzoukas dragonfly, he just talks to it. When the fuck did he learn dragonfly? Like,
anything to
explain it away early makes me not think about it later.
I hate any type of character, especially a child character, that gets anything without work. And the first encounter when he talks about now he understands the animals, he has not put in work at that point. He's not had any, like, real independent scenes with the animals since the very beginning before Robert Downey Jr. became a part of Pirates of the Caribbean, you know? It's easy to get confused around here.
I feel like this is a movie that was originally meant to be 2 hours, and all the really good character stuff with Stubbins was cut because the movie itself is only 90 minutes long.
Yeah.
The credits are 12 minutes.
Yeah.
This is a movie that is just chopped down and chopped down and chopped down to a simple 90-minute runtime so that way you can get more showings in a theater.
Oh, did you guys watch through the credits? There's nothing at the end, but the CGI staff is like three paragraphs of names.
Yeah, it's right. Like those Marvel movies where it's just like a giant credit block. It's huge.
I mean, as long as CGI has been big in post-production, the 10-minute end credits sounds about right. Like, I remember, 25 years ago when the first Mortal Kombat film came out, that was the first time I saw end credits that were like 10 minutes long. It's like, wow, that's a lot of credits. And then just as the years have gone on, it's like they just found ways to kind of compact it, but it's still like 10-plus minutes. So if it's like a small movie with minimal CG, it's like, okay, the end credits are probably going to be like 5 minutes, and they usually are.
Yeah.
Remember when we went to see Guardians of the Galaxy and we were watching through the credits and that credit block shows up on screen and it's just like a whole screen filled with names?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Every Marvel movie nowadays is just a wall, literally a wall of names.
Yeah.
Yeah. It made things very confusing for me, the whole animal speaking thing. Because I liked the bits where we got to see Robert Downey Jr. speaking animal. That was like funny and like added, you know, to his quirkiness.
Could you put funny in air quotes, please?
Yeah, funny. Well, like when he dives into the fish tank to talk to the octopus and it's like snitches get stitches. That got a chuckle out of me. Like that was. I think it's
because you're a little bit younger. I very clearly remember the whole. I mean, being from Baltimore, snitches get stitches was like a big thing. I remember a lot of the early videos from that, like when they came out. So it was, I don't know. What was it?
So stop snitching.
Yeah, the whole stop snitching campaign.
Yeah, but I'm willing to forgive a lot because this is a kid's movie, and so anything that makes me chuckle a little in a kid's movie is probably a good joke for a kid. However, the issues that I'm having while watching this is just how poorly constructed and Frankensteined this whole thing feels at different points. The parrot is narrating mostly because Emma Thompson is just amazing at dictation, but the narration at the beginning with the animation, I get, like, that's textbook. That's like, okay, this is good storytelling. But then it happens only one other time in the middle of the movie to explain what's happening on this island.
They probably cut a scene.
Yeah. But
yeah, I was thinking like the same narration too. Because when they get to that shot of RDJ in disguise, it doesn't feel like a natural transition that was meant to be there. Like, it's an awkward post-production blur.
Why is the kid in disguise? No one has ever seen that kid before in their earthly existence. Why does he need to be disguised? Why is it such a big deal that he keep his disguise on? Please tell me.
Yeah.
Was there a point to that ever?
I think it's a Pirates of the Caribbean thing.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
There's a scene in the first Pirates where they have to be in disguise.
There was probably a very expensive $5 million scene of all the animals putting disguises onto the human characters and them it being like a very funny gag for the kids. And then they at some point they were like, well, we're cutting things. And at this point, this one needs to go. And so there's probably a bunch of like half animated animal disguise scene stuff laying on the cutting room floor.
Yeah, just like rough animatics.
Yeah.
Did anybody else think that the first time you see Doolittle getting dressed, it felt like the scene in Cinderella where she's putting on her dress?
Oh, yeah.
A little bit, yeah. I mean, you do have the mice there, too, so.
Yeah, it's totally, there you go. It's another movie. It feels like a Frankenstein's monster.
I have my major negative of this movie.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. There is a scene in which Ralph Fiennes, or Fiennes, is it Fiennes?
Ralph Fiennes.
The decorated, well-respected actor, Academy Award nominee, plays a tiger with mommy issues, and he gets kicked in the balls, and they made that wonderful actor say the line, berries, berries, as in his balls.
All my berries, berries.
And Any other actor in that, I might have actually got a chuckle out of it, but because it was him, it's the Picard like hand, you know, face palm thing. I was just like, no, why, no, that just hurt. That was my biggest negative. Like from that point on, I was depressed watching the movie. I was no longer like hopeful that good things were gonna happen. I was like, nope, because this happened. Like, well into production. This is post-production shit. Those voices and all of that is so deep, they should have had time to question that decision.
It felt like any time like there was going to be a sincere moment, it immediately gets undercut with a joke.
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
And not a good
one every time. The point where they're supposed to be, like, the rally of the troops moment, where, like, Doolittle's going to say, like, we're not done, we can continue to fight on. He just says, we're finished. Like that's, and he just says, I'm just going to open up a doctor's shop on this island. It's like, come on, man.
Here's one of the frustrations that I have. Like, as someone who is really into filmmaking, if I could get this cast, like, if I could get just, like, four lines of dialogue from all of the actors in this cast to make an animated film, do you have any idea the kind of things that I would be doing? It wouldn't be this. Like, they have so many actors, and it's just so, like, oh my God, this is what you wasted that talent on? Like, this is what you decided to do with that person?
Yeah, I feel like this is the point where we segue into the darkest element of this film, Seth. We will tiptoe around this.
Are there any other negatives before I launch
the
ship?
Who the fuck is supposed to be the likable character in this film?
Craig Robinson is the squirrel.
Okay, fair enough. I'll take it.
Yeah.
He was the only one that was consistently... When the kid is running up on the giraffe and he's like freaking the fuck out, I was like, okay, this is genuinely hilarious. He did just get shot by that kid. That's very funny.
It's very realistic.
It is kind of odd that squirrel did not like explode getting shot by that gun.
Oh.
That was not a very
realistic... You guys ever watched that Best of the Worst video about exploding varmints?
No, because I like small animals. Thank you kindly.
Well, thankfully, they censor the bejesus out of that episode.
Oh, true. Yeah.
It's like all, I think, like skull and crossbones every time.
Yeah.
So I'd like to introduce you guys to a hypothetical parallel universe in which a certain well-decorated actor, we'll call him Bobbert Upney Sr.
Oh, my God.
Has just done a long run of really, really well-received, very, very lucrative films. They're the Revenger films. They're very popular in the mass media.
I don't like where this is going.
So this hypothetical person made lots of money on these movies. I mean, more money than many actors have ever been given for roles. And let's just say hypothetically, the taxes on that were going to be really, really high. Just, you're losing a lot of money. You're going to get taxed a lot on, mm-hmm. on that kind of income.
Yep.
If I were that guy, my plan would maybe be to use my production company and hypothetically piecemeal a movie together out of an IP that's just kind of sitting around collecting dust, get all of my famous friends to jump on board, maybe get my wife to be the producer because we're married and filing jointly. Again, this is all hypothetical.
Allegedly.
Not a thing that actually happened. But if it were me and I wanted to not pay these taxes, I would maybe make a producer situation, a tank on purpose, so that I could, you know, write off more than I actually made on my Revenger movies, hypothetically. Uh-huh. Not saying that's what happened, but... that's it.
Yeah.
You know, in case you were ever curious why this feels like it was kind of rushed, pieced together, CGI not totally done, the plot kind of in rags. Hypothetically, I couldn't know that for sure.
And I'm pretty sure, because isn't it like 25 years that the licensing for IPs, because obviously I think the Dr. Dolittle licensing for the books and stuff like that, the original license has long expired, and then the film rights are continuing the ownership. And I think it's been almost like exactly 25 years since the last one. Isn't that how that works? Isn't it 25 years?
I think it, well, didn't Disney change it to like 70, or was that for something else? I'm no longer speaking hypothetically. I think Disney did something that IP lasts for like 70 years now.
Jesus.
It was some kind of rewriting of their contracts to maintain licenses for longer periods of time.
Yeah, that's fucking stupid.
Oh, maybe I should have done a little research before this. You know, there's 4 Dr. Dolittle movies in the series started by Eddie Murphy.
Is there now?
Yep.
Straight to video.
I actually thought it was five.
Bit of research on Dr. Dolittle, and those didn't come up.
So there are the two with Eddie Murphy in theaters, and then they did the offshoot with the younger daughter, the not Raven Simone. Because I think there was like 3 straight to video sequels after the initial 2. I think they dropped the number after the 3rd one. It was something weird. So you had like 2 theatrical ones and like 2 or 3 straight to video sequels after that.
Oh no, there were 5. Dr. Dolittle, Million Dollar Mutts.
There you go.
There's not even a human on the cover. It's just dogs.
Oh my God.
I've seen the trailers fees on Vudu just for the hell of it, and yeah, they get progressively worse and more like shot on video looking. It's really weird.
Yeah, so definitely not about the rights then. If they've been making that,
2009 was the last one that came out.
That is so funny.
Damn.
I think there's different contracting elements with straight to video compared to theater. If it's a theatrical release, you have to get the rights for something else. Whereas with the straight to video, I think there's different contract rules.
Now, how does that apply if you make a movie and then never release it?
I don't know.
I think
because that's Fantastic
Four
right there.
I think it has to be released, but I don't think it has to be wide release, because I've read of stories where like a film was released to like 8 theaters in the middle of Omaha, Nebraska, because they had to, you know, have it in certain number of theaters in order to extend the rights or to make some contract. Like, I know in situations where like an actor has a contract with a film company and they have to make a film and that film is an absolute bomb, a lot of times it'll be like small theatrical release in 8 theaters in Omaha, Nebraska.
Yeah, when we're discussing films that are allegedly intentionally made to bomb, then it does happen. This is a thing that does happen, and I'm tiptoeing around this very carefully. There are production companies that have done this, and you look at something like infamous now retired director Uwe Boll.
Yep.
He made films intentionally to bomb so that way he would get a tax refund.
Now, those are not hypothetical. I will say that because for the longest time, we all wondered, like, how in the hell is this man still getting money to make these goddamn films? And I think, I can't remember, like, apparently there was, like, one or two that were actually decent, and everybody went, I don't believe you. But none of them were, like, the ones based on video games because, of course, you know, he came onto the scene in the worst possible way with House of the Dead, then Alone in the Dark, then In the Name of the King and Blood Rain and Postal. It's like, how in the fuck... Is he getting all these?
It was tax havens.
Did you guys know that he's like a supervillain on Letterboxd?
Sounds about right.
I'm not kidding. The man takes time out of his day to sit down and review movies that like would come out at the same time as his movies and give them like one star anti-feminist, like incel kind of reviews.
What a shock.
They are, I mean... super sad, but genuinely kind of hilarious when you think about this, like, very angry man who literally boxed one of his critics because he was mad at a review.
God.
Small dick energy.
Oh, yeah. The smallest. Yeah. Hypothetically.
The way in which these films continue to get made is that if you make a lot of money, let's say if an actor made, like, I don't know, $50 million off of Revenger movies, you will probably get taxed $15 million of that.
If not more.
Apparently that's too much because $35 million is too little for a human being to live on. So what they will do is that they will use a tax loophole by losing money on a future production. And then when the next tax season rolls around, they get a massive refund because they can claim a huge loss.
Right.
Like, if you want to compare it to our current political system, the guy running the country at the moment, the way in which he has survived in massive debt is that he will just run up massive bills, and then when tax season rolls around, he can claim a massive loss and gets a huge refund from the IRS and just laughs his way all the way to the bank.
Yep.
This is not hypothetical. This happens. This kind of stuff does happen. This is not like an allegedly. Like that he did that.
Yes. Those are on paper. In the case
That's
of Doolittle,
can be proven.
In the case of Doolittle, this is all hypothetical.
This is all allegedly, but it's a little too perfect. Makes a little too much sense. We don't have the proof of it, so we're just going to say allegedly, but I would kind of lump Doolittle in with like Adam Sandler's film Jack and Jill.
Ooh.
Or those Aaron Seltzer, Jason Freeberg mockbuster movies where they're intentionally made to sort of profit off of failure films.
This kind of felt like that at times, just the way it would like reference movies with no setup, like nothing leading up to it. It's just suddenly there are ants and sugar cubes and now I'm in The Godfather and I don't know how I got here. I felt like a hostage at different points in the movie of like,
oh good, yeah.
What is
I felt like a hostage the entire movie.
So that's kind of an unfortunate darkness in Hollywood in general.
Films that are made to fail by studios, like, or films that are made to not be released, like we just mentioned Fantastic Four, the what was it, 1994 when that movie came out?
Well, supposed to.
But it looked like it was shot in 1970.
It looks like a TV pilot, basically.
Yeah, it looked like a TV pilot. Yeah, or that, or what else? I think The Mummy. Wasn't the 2017 Mummy? Also, they kind of jacked up the budget because they saw that the script wasn't good enough or something like that.
I mean, the fact that they were putting all their eggs in that Dark Universe basket, I don't know about that one.
Yeah, there's a bunch of movies that do that where they will just crank up the budget in order to kind of get a tax refund when the next tax season rolls around.
Yeah.
It is what it is.
So apparently Dr. Doolittle, the character, is in the public domain.
Oh, okay.
Huh.
Oh, that's probably why, because Sherlock Holmes is public domain, Doolittle is public domain, they don't have to pay for rights to the character.
Right.
I wonder how that works for like specific books in the series versus the characters themselves. Because copyright laws with stuff like that gets really
murky. It's so confusing.
Yeah.
Well, and it that, probably it probably applies, like, Sherlock Holmes is like, oh, well, there's short stories, but then there's also full novels. It's like, there's probably different rights issues with that.
Well, maybe. And that's why you also never get, like, full send-ups of Sherlock Holmes stories. You'd get, like, Hounds of the Baskerville, but the twist is it's, you know, set in the future, and it's now genetically modified dogs, like in the TV series, or, you know, they do, like, enough different that it's not exactly Hound of the Baskerville.
Yeah. The worst of all of the Sherlock Holmes stories.
It's so boring.
And the one we had to read is required reading in middle school.
I guess, like, I dodged that bullet.
I had to read it. It was a dog.
The whole time. I wish there were more to say about this, because the premise is great. A man who can talk to animals. That sounds fun. That's something I always wanted as a child. I wanted to be a zoologist when I was 8.
That's why it upsets me that this is so bad, because I would do so many cool things with this superpower, and I'm like, you chose to do this? This? Really? You sad sack motherfucker.
You pack it with stars, you drive up the budget, you get a tax refund, and you get to pay all your friends a lot of money, and it's...
Allegedly.
Allegedly, that's what happened.
Y'all can make fun of me for being the one outside the podcast saying...
No, it was a good choice. It was a good choice. I feel safe in my hypothetical chair over here.
Mm-hmm.
I want to end on the way this movie ends, which is...
A fart? You're going to fart in the mic.
I mean, I could, but I might actually shit myself.
That's content. Man, Patreon
this
content.
Ending. This ending, I swear.
A well-sounding short is you can't really appreciate in just sound, so it's really going to be kind of wasted. Might
it's
be
true.
A little wetter than your standard fart, but...
Just a little smell-o-vision is needed.
Can we also add in, this came out in January, this is a fuck you, it's January movie?
Yeah. January of 2020, how appropriate.
Yeah.
Fuck you, it's January!
For those that don't understand what Fuck You, It's January is, Red Letter Media has a thing they call Fuck You, It's January. January is kind of seen as a dumping ground for a lot of bad movies. Studios will offload their garbage in order to try to get tax refunds for the following season. It happens. It's sometimes you get lucky. Like Ex Machina came out in January.
Yeah.
That's a fantastic film. Like,
there can be good ones in January. They're just definitely the exception rather than the rule.
Yeah. Occasionally there's some good ones, but they didn't think Ex Machina was going to be very good. They were like, oh, it's slow and boring? Who wants to see that?
The Oscars, apparently.
Yeah.
A lot of times you'll have, like, independent films that will be like, well, you know, ordinarily our slow film is not going to compete against Hollywood. If we put it in January, it'll have a, you know, a snowball's chance in hell against not being against a major market like DC, you know, slow-ass paced film, you know?
Yeah. What month just, like, within the last 5 years went from being another shit month to, like, a good month? I want to say it was, like, April or February, but it was...
September?
September. September's usually the other dumping ground, because it's between the summer blockbuster season and the Oscar season.
It's gotten a little better. January's still more often one of the shittier months, but September, you have a better chance in September than you do January.
September can get some good horror films, because trying to get the early capitalizing on the spoopy market. Yeah.
Spoopy market.
Yes.
You know what film came out in September in 2012?
What?
Dread.
Oh.
That's why it failed.
That hurts.
You should have released it in, like, July or something like that.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
What else? There's no villain in the movie, really. Like, Michael Sheen is kind of the villain, but then he just kind of doesn't do a ton and shows up at the end in what... how many of these sets were Pirates of the Caribbean sets? I need to know that, because at least
they
the
look
boat...
too cheap to be Pirates of the Caribbean sets.
That
yeah, it's too cheap. Too cheap.
There were CGI recreations of the Pirates of the Caribbean sets.
Yeah.
If you told me every single set was literally digital, I wouldn't question it.
The CG Mandalorian sets looked more realistic.
And, like, I don't know. what's going on. Some movies that I stream are just very intensely oversaturated, and this was one of them. Like, most stuff that I watch on my TV is not very intensely oversaturated. I don't know if it's just this one streaming service, but I don't know if the movie is intended to be this way or what happened. It was so green for me. Seth told me that it was not for him, so maybe this was just the streaming that I was getting it from, but, like, it was so green.
It looked orange to me.
Well, oversaturated, I guess, would probably just be
It doesn't look realistic. Let's
it was
put it
very
that way.
Fake looking.
Yeah, it's
even
very fake.
Even when I was probably looking at real grass, I was not convinced it was real grass. That's a fucking problem.
I mean, you were high as fuck watching this, so maybe
yes,
that might be something to do with it.
Probably not.
Did you guys know that Tommy's cousin, the other boy that was at the beginning and end of the movie, that's Andy Serkis's son?
Huh.
That's why he kind of had like a familiar looking face, but I can't really
see. Yeah.
Not surprised.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
Also, I thought they were brothers, and I didn't know they were cousins until just now looking at the Wikipedia, because it is unclear as fuck in the movie.
It feels like the family just kind of drops out of the film.
Oh, yeah.
Like, they don't give a shit where their kid went.
And so does Lady Rose. That's the saddest part.
That's the crux of the film, and, like, no one even talks to her most of the movie. She just kind of lays in that bed.
Oh, no, yeah. No, I mean the younger one, Lady... Yeah, Lady Rose.
Lady Mary.
The
Oh, sorry, Lady Rose. Jeez, I don't even know her name.
Yeah, so Queen Victoria was in the bed, and then Lady Rose was the girl that
not love interest for the kids.
Yeah, okay. they set up this like obvious, you know, three person adventure movie. You know,
then one person doesn't go along on the adventure,
and then they're just like, yeah, let's ditch the girl and do our own thing. And I was like, wait, is this for real? What?
So yeah, I feel like we were trying to place blame on the director/writer, but it looks like there were three different writers, and two of them primarily focused on sitcoms.
Yeah.
So I'm starting to wonder.
And it wasn't funny.
That's why this feels like a sitcom.
Yeah, I mean, to the point that even Seth Rogen was approached and turned this down, like, hard and fast. If you want to hear a version of our allegedly spiel without the allegedlies, you can listen to him on, I think it was...
Joe Rogan.
No, it wasn't Rogan. It was Howard Stern. He was on Howard Stern, and he was, like, explaining the process of shit scripts that just...
Yeah,
appear to do things.
Scam scripts.
Scam scripts. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Where it's like, just, you know, you got people who are capable of writing and someone who's capable of directing and actors capable of acting, and everything's going to figure itself out in the end. And usually that lands on these poor editors. That's a positive I should have added. Whoever the poor people were that had to edit this thing into something watchable, even remotely watchable, some of the takes that they had to use because Robert Downey Jr. is facing away from the camera so that they can deliver important lines, just editors are just gods among men to be able to do that kind of magic. There was a couple different times I was like, holy shit, what a way to fix that goddamn glaring problem.
Yeah, there's a scene in The Wire, and I referenced this, like, I think a couple of weeks ago. There's a scene, I think, in season 3 or 4 where the outgoing mayor is talking to the incoming mayor, and he's talking about, well, when I walked into the office on the first day, a bunch of my cabinet members were like, here's this bowl of shit, eat up. And I was like, all right, I guess I'll eat this shit. And I walk in the next day, and they hand me another bowl, and I'm like, this looks like shit. And they're like, yeah, eat up. And I walk in the next day, and they hand me another bowl, and they're like, eat up. And I was like, how much shit do I have to eat while I'm in this office? And they said, one bowl for every day you're in this fucking office. That's editors in Hollywood.
Yep. I can't... Oh, man. There must have been some late nights, maybe even hypothetical...
Hair pulling, chain-smoking sessions.
Hypothetical cocaine binges just to get through.
What was the coke budget on this movie?
Oh, man.
Not enough.
I mean, granted, we've all heard the joke from Tropic Thunder about... you guys did see the MTV Movie Awards skit when Tropic Thunder was coming out, where it was Ben Stiller calling out Robert Downey Jr. and seeing like, well, at least I didn't get caught in Las Vegas with a suitcase full of blow and a hooker in a hotel room. And then Robert Downey Jr. is like, okay, you just crossed the line.
Oh, okay. I want to call out these editors, mostly because I respect them so much. So... Craig Alpert and Chris Lebenzin are
those
the edit
familiar.
They are. So Chris Lebenzin works with Tim Burton a lot.
Oh, that makes perfect sense.
And then Craig Alpert has worked on basically every kind of movie that you can do throughout his career. And he's worked with the Wachowskis, Ang Lee, David Zucker, Judd Apatow, Elizabeth Banks, David Leitch. Like, there's a reason they brought this movie to these two.
And the fact that there's two of them, yet the movie's only 90 minutes.
Yes.
It says that one of them was trying to do it, couldn't figure it out, brought in another one, and they had to sort of rescue it in editing.
Yeah. Yep.
That's about right.
Whenever you have multiple editors on a film, it's usually because the first one just had a meltdown and couldn't do it.
I can imagine trying to edit that opening bit with when he's got the beard and they're doing surgery on a squirrel. I can imagine what that must have been like to edit. That just
and not just that, it's like most of the shots are like plate shots because there's so much CGI in the movie. So
oh,
it's
yeah.
like having to put that together and assemble it. It's like, what are you filming? Like, what's there on the editing table? Like, it's just plate shots until you're waiting for the CGI to roll in.
His house was like the only non-CGI set, I think, in the whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, there's that. There's a little bit in the Pirate's Cove, wherever the hell it is.
Oh yeah, yeah, maybe the jail cell.
Yeah, but that's basically it. Everything else is kind of against the green screen. Like, the whole cave is a green screen.
So this movie's not good.
No, I don't. Never watch this. Never watch this.
You don't need to. There's nothing. It's not even like a fun drunk watch, I don't think.
Trying to do a commentary on this would just be like us just groaning and just drinking.
It would be pointing out bad jokes and like amazing editing options.
I was pretty confident that I could get high enough that the talking animals would entertain my ass. I got high and I did some history research on Wikipedia so I could make a better pitch. That's what I did instead of watching the movie.
The polar bear ostrich bromance, I'm not gonna lie, that was endearing. I'd watch their movie.
Yeah. I can't swim and I can't fly. Yeah. Okay, that's kind of funny, but
what bird things do you do? Well, I run fast. No, I run fast. What bird things do you do?
Yeah.
I get the feeling they were like just happened to be in the studio on the same days, and so they got to actually play off each other for that stuff. Because that feels
right.
You know, ad-libbed. John Cena is a funny guy. Like, I don't...
He is.
Oh, yeah.
Ironically, I feel like John Cena was channeling Seth Rogen at times.
Well, that's the role that was...
Because.
I wouldn't be surprised. Here, do your best Seth Rogen. Why? Don't ask. Just do. Okay.
Yeah.
And listen, Rami Malek sounding like Josh Gad. It was very confusing.
Oh,
it was very
weird. Oh, my
God.
When I saw that he was actually the polar bear in this movie, or the gorilla in this movie, I was like, wait a minute, what?
Yep.
Yeah.
Are you kidding? Oscar winner Rami Malek is playing that?
Yep.
A lot of Oscar winners and nominees in this.
Oh, like we said, it's star packing. That's what it is.
Top to bottom, cast and crew. I
was trying to pull it out of the fire and they couldn't do it.
I feel like we almost owe it to all the talent in this to go watch like one of their better things to just like wet the palate and be like, oh, that's right, there's a reason they're so good at this. Oh, thank God.
Yeah.
Let's take a quick break, and when we come back, Aaron has a page one rewrite fix for this.
Throw the whole thing into the garbage.
Because that's what we need here. I'm like, yep, yeah, I don't want any of this. This sucks.
Yeah.
Oh boy.
Oh man.
We will be right back.
What a pile of shit. I'm truly shocked. I'm just dumbfounded of this scam of a movie, allegedly. Yes, it's me, Jesse. I'm here doing your film recommendation for the week. I was going to recommend a movie that involves talking animals, but I didn't want to recommend any of the other Dr. Dolittle films that Eddie Murphy was in because I just feel like that's a cheap shot and it's too easy to pick those. And I think they're fine, but I don't think they're really like, you know, you have to go out and see them. So I was trying to think of a movie that involved talking animals, and I thought about recommending the Babe movies, Babe and Babe Pig in the City, the George Miller films, and I haven't seen them recently enough to recommend them. I'd say probably see them, but they're not what I'd recommend at the moment. So instead, I'm going to recommend a movie from my childhood that involves not talking animals, but talking aliens. I'm recommending a movie called Flight of the Navigator. This is a film made by Disney back in the 1980s, and it's about a young 12-year-old boy who gets abducted by an alien and is brought back to Earth somehow, and it turns out years have passed. And it seems that due to the time dilation of getting to and from the alien world, I think about 7 years have gone by, and this kid is kind of lost in a man out of time, kind of like a Captain America sort of situation. And he's trying to come to terms with it, and NASA basically puts him under observation, trying to understand what's going on with the alien spacecraft that they apparently have in their hangar, which is the ship that abducted him. He gets into the ship, befriends the alien that's inside of it, and they take off on a wild adventure. It's fun, it's colorful, it's kind of goofy and over the top. Paul Reubens, Pee-wee Herman himself, is the voice of the alien, although he changed his name for the film because he didn't want to give it away that it was actually him. It's a lot of fun. It's a cute movie. Sarah Jessica Parker is in the movie, although she said in an interview she doesn't remember making the movie. It shows how much time she actually spends in the actual film. She's in like 3 scenes and she's gone. It's a fun movie. I'd recommend it. It was supposed to have a remake or a reboot at some point. I don't know if it's ever going to get off the ground. But it's not like a masterpiece, but it's very well done. It has a killer soundtrack, and I'd definitely recommend you check it out. It's a fun relic from the 1980s. It's definitely one that's worth your time. That's called Flight of the Navigator. And now, back to the pitch.
Welcome back to the Film Rescue Show. We're talking about Doolittle, and we're about to page one this bitch.
Thank God.
Aaron, you had some mighty, mighty ideas last night that you were bouncing off of me. I'm very here for it. Any kind of like direct thought being applied to this story is going to feel better in general. But it's not just a MacGuffin adventure anymore. You've really transformed this. So take it away. This is your pitch.
Perfect. So first off, one of the things that I really hate is that a lot of times when you have these stories that are written in like the Victorian era, no one ever really adapts them outside of the Victorian era. I mean, until very recently, it wasn't like you didn't have Sherlock in modern times. It was always Victorian era Sherlock. So I really wanted to get him out of the Victorian era, and I wanted to get him into an era that isn't explored super, super often by Hollywood, and also that feels very pertinent to modern day. And that year is 1932. It is, in the midst of the Great Depression. Hoover is president, and the film is going to take place very, very near us in Anacostia. Let me give you a little bit of a background. It's just very, very short historically, so you know where we're at. There were these things back then called Hoovervilles. It was a disparaging name because Hoover was an unpopular president. And they were shanty towns full of migrant people who had been displaced by the Great Depression and were looking for something, you know, something to eat, somewhere to stay, stuff like that. So specifically in 1932, unemployed World War I veterans, all from across the country, marched to Washington to demand immediate payment of a bonus that they had been promised. The event became known as the Bonus Army Conflict, and most of this Bonus Army camped on the Anacostia Flats, which at the time was a swampy, muddy, just nothing sort of area. And basically the president ordered Douglas MacArthur to deal with it. With that little bit of information in mind, I'm going to throw you into my pitch. It's the Great Depression. We start with Doolittle, whose clothes once were very nice and high fashion, but are now dirty and becoming tattered. He's in a large mansion, but it's starting to fall into disarray. It's Art Deco style, but you see him call for a servant at first, before remembering that he had to let them all go when the stock market crashed. He goes into the kitchen to find something to eat, and the cupboards are bare. His stomach growls, and he looks down, seeing a feather. Outside the window is a large chicken coop, where a few chickens remain. He checks quickly for eggs, and finds none, before slowly closing his eyes and pulling out a cleaver. There's a brief fade to black. Then we see a chicken on the cutting block. Doolittle's expression is agonized. Then the chicken speaks. Who does this help? Just you? What have you done for anybody? You cut to clips from the past where Dr. Doolittle is ignoring the plights of those around him. While he is in a mansion, everyone else in the town is fairly poor, and they are struggling even more than he is. What do you want me to do? Dr. Doolittle asks. The chicken is exasperated. What have you done for yourself? What have you done for others? We see another clip from the past. A woman is begging for him for assistance, and he brushes her off without a word as he's too preoccupied with his life. He sighs, he mounts up his horse, he rides into the small Hooverville where he knew the woman would be headed to. She's a farmer by trade and her mules are ill. He helps tend to the mules and she gives him what little food that she has to spare from her garden. She's a widow. She explains that her husband was a doctor in the bonus army, that she marched with him to this encampment, and that he died due to the conditions. While she hasn't been to medical school herself, she admits to reading all of her husband's books, and she's also got a background in herbal medicine and such. She's been marching with the bonus army for a long time. Her name is Juliana, and she is tough as nails. You kind of get some scenes where, you know, Dr. Doolittle is kind of trying to kind of win her over, but she knows that he's not one of them, and she kind of keeps him at a distance. She'll give him food because he can speak to the animals and find local, like, berries and other things that, like, herbal medicine that she needs. So they kind of start developing a little bit of a light truce. Then General Patton shows up with his troops. Douglas MacArthur, upon the orders from Hoover to go deal with the bonus army, believed that the army was filled with communists who were demanding money that they didn't have rights to. So Patton responds, maybe not in the bestest of manner. The bonus army, they cheer. They think they're getting support because these are troops. These are men who in a few years are going to be veterans like themselves. They think they're going to support their cause. Then General Patton orders them to charge. Doolittle has been aware that there's going to be something wrong because the horses in Patton's cavalry have communicated to him that shit ain't right, and he orders Juliana and the others nearby to leave. Patton orders the cavalry to charge, the encampment gets torched, there's general chaos. Fortunately, Doolittle and his little group of people get away. They flee back across the Anacostia River. There are some close moments where there's a dog on their tail, but he begs with the dog to let them go, and there's an intense scene of, like, almost hostage negotiation where they're trying to negotiate with this dog to not bark and make the other troops aware to their location. Eventually, they end up at a second camp on the other side of the Anacostia, where the survivors of the bonus army conflict are gathering. You see various scenes of Dr. Doolittle living amongst the survivors and using help from the animals to survive. Having large deer help pull branches in so they can make structures, finding native pawpaw fruit and gourds so they can have food to survive. At first it's really awkward because they perceive Doolittle as being used to being rich. So they're like, you know, why are you playing poverty? You can just go back to your mansion. Like, yes, you didn't have a lot of food there, but you can use your animal help to find your own food. Why are you still here with us? He has some sort of emotional scene. I'm thinking maybe you get a scene of his childhood. You see that he didn't maybe grow up that way, and he just has let his fortune in life kind of corrupt him, and that, you know, being among them has made him realize what truly matters again. All of the veterans and their families are coming together to build this camp. You have women making sack dresses and quilts together, yada, yada, yada. Hoover doesn't get reelected. It's a big lulz. Roosevelt instead gets elected, and he is forced to deal with that whole homeless veteran situation in Anacostia. He sends his wife, Eleanor. Like, can we just pause for a second? This is historical fact. Hoover sent the fucking army and Roosevelt sent his fucking wife to deal with this situation.
It's true.
It's true. Yeah. So Eleanor
small dick
brings...
versus big dick energy.
I know, right? Eleanor brings the family's German Shepherd Major and their Scottish Terrier Meggie. They are dogs from real life. Eleanor specifically used to make sure that the dogs could come along with them, even when like official engagements would otherwise make it difficult. So they had a close in real life relationship with their animals. So the initial discussions between the Bonus Army and Eleanor Roosevelt are not looking super great. We don't have Doolittle in the room. He's getting notes passed along by these various different animals. So you've got like a literal fly on the wall. You've got a few bugs, you know, just stupid little fucking puns because I love that shit. So you can kind of get the vibe that negotiations are going poorly. So poorly that Major bites one of the veterans in the ass, tearing his pants. He did bite someone in real life, tearing their pants. It was not that specific veteran, but it was too funny of a story for me not to include it. And it's looking like all is lost. Then Doolittle sees Meggie, the Roosevelt's beloved Scottish Terrier. She's swallowing something she shouldn't have, and she is not looking well. She was a really, really fat dog in real life. So the dog needs emergency surgery. Doolittle works on it, and Juliana helps out in surgery with some, you know, herbs and things like that for like astringent properties, and you know, like so the dog doesn't have to feel pain, all that jazz. Eleanor is so happy that she promises the veterans the best thing that she can give them, which are positions in civilian conservation corps. It was kind of a works aid service for men that didn't ordinarily allow married men. It was only for unmarried men, and Eleanor Roosevelt had kind of allowed other men from this group to participate into that, and that, and then her husband would eventually expand that aid as well, thus putting an end to that conflict. So this is great for most of the people there, but Juliana is a widow, and this program is for men, so she's kind of like, okay, you know, I've done really well. I guess I'm just going to go back, you know, find some farmland of my own, settle down. I can take care of myself. And Doolittle leans in. His eyes meet. He looks at her. Do you know what I'm thinking? He asks. She gives him a languishing smile. Yes, I think I would like to open a veterinary clinic with you. As long as you understand your position, John Doolittle. And he replies, of course, Lady Do-Well. Then you see a flash forward of their vet's office and the sign that says on the front, Do-Well and Do-Little.
Aww. This rings of like, I don't often like to name drop the big director names, but this feels like perfect material for Spielberg, who can do like,
yeah,
like,
I agree.
Like, time period serious movies and like, you know, kind of lighter, more adventure stuff. This like fits both of his wheelhouses so well. I would love to see like, this is like the War Horse version of Dr. Doolittle, right?
I was literally thinking War Horse.
That sounds about right.
I was literally thinking War Horse.
I hate how like with the Doolittle character, they, because there's 13 novels. The first thing I researched is Doolittle always doing this kind of thing that he's doing in the movie? He does all sorts of crazy stuff.
Yep.
Like the only thing that's really set in stone about the character is his speech to animals. And I wanted to use that in some sort of different way. And the Great Depression, the failure of Hoover as a president, all of that is very analogous to the situation that we're in 2020 with, you know, a president handing a shit situation in the most shit possible way. I like the fact that it allowed me to have a woman come in. Fucking Eleanor Roosevelt saved the day. Like, I wasn't quite sure what 1932 conflict I wanted to use, but the fact that this happened near us and involved a woman saving the day, I'm like, well, fuck, sign me up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
The kind of character we don't get much anymore, and when these books are being written in the 20s, the idea of the Renaissance man, your Sherlock Holmes, your John Carter of Mars, your people that like Dr. Doolittle, these characters were written as the kind of person that can fill any position. Roald Dahl in real life.
I guess in current day, I think that the term Mary Sue, I guess, is thrown around at this point.
Right.
Yeah, that's the modern phraseology of Renaissance man.
Exactly.
I don't totally stand by, because I think you can make a character that has lots of skills. Like, lots of people have many skills. Like, David Lynch is not just a filmmaker. He's also, he's not just a filmmaker. He's a writer. He's a painter. He's a musician. He does everything.
Yeah.
You can have these people do exist. Like, you can have a character that's very good at everything. But that also creates a conflict for a later story, is that you introduce a problem that they don't have a skill set for.
Right, and that's how many of these books were written, was specifically Dr. Doolittle. A lot of the stuff tended to be either, like what Aaron's suggesting, big problems that one person, no matter how skilled, can't fix.
Mm-hmm.
You know, something political, something affecting a large portion of people. I sent her, early in the pitch, I sent her the Stone Soup. Was a kid's book that I read growing up, and to summarize it, this Renaissance man shows up to town, and everyone's starving, and he says, "Well, let's make stone soup." And they're like, "How do you make stone soup?" And so he starts asking people what they have, and basically everyone in town has some kind of ingredient, and then at the end he drops this little rock into the pot, and it's basically vegetable soup with a rock in the bottom. But he but he taught them they could all come together and make everyone else's lives easier by being together. That's where I thought she was going with it initially. I love the more historical version of it, though. That's like,
and I did include that, and that's kind of like the women coming together and making sack dresses and patchwork quilts. It's both historically accurate as something that happened in a Hooverville, and something that I wanted to find the stone soup for our Hooverville, and I decided it was sack dresses and quilts.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Brandon, thoughts, ideas, any visuals pop into mind while she was giving the pitch?
Somewhat, yeah. I mean, I hate to bring up Wizarding World, but it was one of the Fantastic Beasts movies that really had that early 30s, or early 1900s, I should say, look to it that kind of started popping into my head. But I do agree with the period piece style from Spielberg about how he can kind of just, like, waltz into that with no problem. So I think somewhere in between, you know, that style Spielberg and that style set design, you would have the look of this pitch.
I had considered Kubrick Full Metal Jacket style as being a potential.
Not sure how.
Not in 2020. Not in 2020, but obviously. But, you know.
Well, obviously not in 2020. He is a corpse.
Wait, so for, like, visual style, you mean?
Everything, like tone and everything. I think there's some interesting parallels that could be made. Like, because that movie is very funny, but also it has some really seriously fucked up stuff in it.
Yeah.
I mean, it involves the Vietnam War, so a little bit.
Realistically, anything that involves war.
True.
I would lean maybe more P.T. Anderson.
Hmm.
I was just thinking, like, There Will Be Blood. Like, if you want to see, like, the shanty towns of
sure,
you know, seeing it all, like, this the collapse of the United States, seeing that in, like, long takes. I'm just I don't know, I'm just getting visions of that.
Yeah, I could see that. Okay, so you've also presented a interesting, I don't want to call it a conundrum, but an interesting opportunity here. By setting it in America at this time, is your Dr. Doolittle American? Is he going to be like an immigrant? Since immigration was huge at this point, what are you thinking character-wise?
I'm thinking probably immigrant. One of the reasons that I did like this the Anacostia Shantyville is because you had people coming from all over the United States who had been in World War I, and a lot of those people were people who were immigrants and who were not white and who had joined the military to try and make their citizenship path easier. And, you know, and now we're starving, and even after fighting and risking their lives for the country. So I like the ability to have a kind of realistic scenario where you've got all of these different people from different backgrounds, even in that time period, working together for a common goal.
Sure. Do you have a casting in mind at all?
Nope.
Well,
just definitely not Robert Downey Jr.
No, God, no.
Yeah, like, if you're going to say the character's Welsh, get a Welsh actor. Like, who's...
I know.
Find a list of Welsh actors. Like, Seth, can you look that
Absolutely.
Up? There's got to be somebody on a list of Welsh actors that we can pull from.
Welsh is also, like, one of the oddest accents, because it's so... Oh! Oh, shit. From Game of Thrones, the one that cut the guy's dick off. What was his name? Oh.
Theon?
No, Theon was the one who had his dick cut off.
Stannis.
Ewan Rayon. There we go. Thank you, JD. Yes, yeah. So he's Welsh, originally. Also, our first, or I guess second, Reed Richards, Ewan Griffith. Grufford?
Ewan Grufford.
Ewan Grufford, yeah.
I think he also played Horatio Hornblower, I think, at one point.
Oh, interesting. He's Welsh. Mark Lewis Jones. If you Google it, you'll recognize his face. So an issue that I have is Dr. Doolittle is supposed to be an older character. He's supposed to have that kind of like Doctor Who-ish feel to him as compared to a Johnny Depp type or a RDJ type. So I would be very fine casting an older actor into the role. Jonathan Pryce. He's Welsh.
Yes, him, because I love Brazil. Yes, him. Also, he was in Pirates of the Caribbean.
Yes, he was.
So yeah, I'd say Jonathan Pryce.
Yeah, I'm
okay with that.
That's just
Wait,
me.
Catherine Zeta-Jones is Welsh?
Yeah, you didn't know
that. I did not know that.
I did not know that.
Yeah, she is.
Wild.
She usually plays American characters.
Yeah, interesting. Anyways, yeah, that's a good acting. Yeah, good acting. Good actor choice. What about any... Eleanor Roosevelt. Who would you want to cast as her?
Oh, God.
That's
Tilda Swinton. Fucking Tilda Swinton. How old was she at that time, though? Wait, she was... Eleanor Roosevelt birth. Oh, yeah, she would have been in her, like, 50s then. It's totally fine. Definitely Tilda Swinton for her.
Oh, wait.
Either Tilda Swinton for her or for Juliana. Just because, you know, if it's my movie, I'm casting Tilda is the lead girl.
Okay. That's fine.
Phoebe Waller-Bridge from Fleabag kind of looks like Eleanor Roosevelt to me. Do you guys know who I mean?
I have no idea who you're talking about.
Nope.
Phoebe Waller-Bridge. She was also in... who was she in? Solo? Oh, no, she was the voice of the robot in Solo. That's who.
Okay, yeah, I've seen her in some stuff.
It's not like a one-to-one, but if you look at some of her pictures next to Eleanor Roosevelt, they have a similar face.
Oh, yeah, she's on that show Fleabag.
Yeah,
that's right.
Killing.
Yeah, not a great show, but she's good.
Eleanor Roosevelt would have been 48 at the time. But, like, dude, so you got Eleanor Roosevelt, General Patton, before he's, like, General Patton. Dwight D. Eisenhower was one of the other people that marched on this. You've got Hoover and President Roosevelt. Like, you've got some serious big guns. Anacostia is within spitting distance of the U.S. Capitol, so you can have some nice U.S. Capitol during the decay time of the Great Depression. Like, there's so many good visuals that are just immaculate parallels to modern day.
Yeah.
As soon as I saw this event, I'm like, oh, this is definitely the one that I'm using.
Hmm. Yeah, it's definitely one of those things that, like, also isn't talked about much.
It's kind of a forgotten period in history. Basically, it's between the events.
Yeah.
Between the time of the Great Depression and World War II, everybody just kind of forgets about that period of history.
Yeah.
The only films that really happen for those time periods tend to be war films.
Yeah, yeah.
The other time period is about 100 years before this that I'd love to see in a movie was back when Central Park was Seneca Village. It was like a free African-American village in the middle of Manhattan and then got like fucking bulldozed to make Central Park. It is a graphically ugly part of American history that has never been committed to film.
The burning of Black Wall Street.
Yep.
At least I was alive when was it either Philadelphia or Pittsburgh got firebombed because I don't know, white people didn't like the fact that black people were succeeding without them, pretty much. I don't remember the exact reason, but that's what it boils down to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There are
Watchmen
kind of
covered that a little bit.
Where the government has been against us, and we tend to just gloss over those phases of life. And I really wanted to cover the transition from Hoover's leadership to Roosevelt's leadership and how that like helped get out of the shit.
Well, that also lends itself to like a really great act two switchover as you go into the second half of your movie, like literally that changes hands and tones. Yeah, it's pretty perfect. Brandon, Mr. Playlist for Movies guy, who would you want to see score something like this? A darker, more realistic, I don't want to say gritty because it doesn't feel gritty, but you know what I mean?
It's more hopeful, honestly.
Yeah.
I try to have a consistent a thread of hope throughout the entire plot.
Yeah, a Dr. Dolittle period piece. Who would you want to helm that for music?
I'm trying to nail that down as well. I feel like one name that's not tossed around enough, and I don't know why this just popped into my head, maybe because of Who Framed Roger Rabbit, I don't know, is Alan Silvestri.
Ooh.
I mean, he also did Back to the Future, which is all over the timeline, so.
Very true. Didn't he just do the Revenger movies?
Yeah.
3 out of 4. He didn't do the worst of the four. That was Brian Tyler. But Silvestri did 1, 3, and 4. That's all I'm going to say.
Ooh, he's scoring the Witches remake. I'm instantly more interested, as if I wasn't
also
before.
Also directed by Zemeckis.
That gif of Anne Hathaway I have watched like 70 times.
Yeah.
Oh, her going full Melina?
Yes.
Nice.
JD just said in the chat, Michael Giacchino. Yeah, I'll go with that.
That'd be fun. I could see that.
Yeah, I like Giacchino.
Yeah, this definitely has to be like an orchestral score, right? There's no other soundscape that would work with this.
I don't imagine hearing an electric guitar in the 1920s.
God, no. But you know what? Some diegetic sound from, like, because they're probably getting news about the election and stuff like that over radio. Some diegetic sound of some, like, jazz would be real nice, I think.
Mm.
True.
Or
a little bit of...
Yeah, I guess it would have been swingy kind of stuff at that time, too, right?
Yeah, that too. Yep.
Yeah. I think swing was just starting to kick up at that point. It kicked in the 1930s.
There's something a through line. As you were talking, I'd love to include into this. So specifically, Dr. Dolittle's all about communication, right? He can communicate with animals. Problems are fixed by communicating with each other in your pitch. It's all about people talking to each other. And at this time, this would be, what, just right after the genesis of talkies, right? The sound motion pictures. Animals were used a lot. I mean, they've always been used a lot in films. But at that time, getting animals into films was a big thing. I would love some kind of either like short theater scene, or maybe there's like a cleared out theater that Dr. Dolittle gets a movie playing on for a gang of, you know, the people and the animals that have been working together. And, you know, just again, I'm just wanking the same thing that I say every time. I want a scene of characters sitting down and talking to each other so that we can learn about their characters.
I have an idea. I have an idea for a
scene. Oh, sure.
So Dolittle's in a theater watching a film, and the people that are in the scene, like there's a dog barking or there's a horse in the background neighing or something like that, and they're just hearing that as animal sounds, but because Dolittle understands their language, he's hearing like the animals like criticizing the actors how terrible they are as actors.
That would be so funny.
This director's a hack.
And like everybody in the theater is taking it seriously, and he's just laughing.
Laughing his ass
off. To him, it's a comedy.
That's great. That. Oh, yeah, I love that.
Oh, yeah. Man.
Yeah, that's definitely like a straight up trailer bait thing too. The whirring lights and the black and white and Dr. Dolittle sitting in a theater with animals. That's shit you throw in your trailer. I love that.
Yeah.
Any other thoughts, ideas, pitches, things we want to sprinkle in here?
No, it's pretty solid.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe like the woman's name, not what was it? Do well, call it, call her name, do more.
I didn't like that because it's just going to be a sex pun. I do well is kind of going to be a sex pun, but do more is definitely going to be a
that's fair.
Do her more.
Fair.
Yeah.
That's funny.
At least do her well implies that they're going to actually put effort into it.
Right.
that's true. True.
I did consider a lot of different variables for that because I wanted it to be a funny pun name, but I'm like, oh.
Yeah.
So there was a movie about this comic book character called Kong Gorilla. It came out in 1932, and that might be our film right there. Is it an actual gorilla, or is it a man in a gorilla suit is what I'm wondering.
Ooh, interesting.
I don't know. I've never even heard of it.
Originally, Cheech was actually a chimpanzee and not a gorilla. I think they changed it to a gorilla just so he could fight the tiger.
Yeah, I was thinking that too.
Because the other thing is, like, chimpanzees and gorillas can be taught how to speak with sign language. I wish that had been touched on in some degree.
Yep.
You know, but
I know.
Here we are.
Well, he can hear them talking, so why would you teach them sign language?
Well, that's what I'm saying. The Cheech could communicate with the kid sooner if the kid already knew sign language.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
You know, it's like, because when you're introducing the idea of animals having language, you want to take some stepping stones to get there, right? So,
right, yeah.
A logical one is one that happens in the real world. Kong Gorilla, the first sound movie
made entirely in Africa.
Oh, this would be so fun for them to be watching in the theater.
Yeah, because here's the thing. They actually have native African pygmy people in here. So if the animals are sitting there like, God, can you believe these fucking colonists coming in here and taking movies and not helping the, you know, and not fucking around when they're not wanted? Oh, my God. We could have so many interesting commentaries there.
I read Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness.
Tarzan. I was like, I know there was a big animal thing happening at this time. Tarzan.
Yeah. You could have a cameo by Edgar Rice Burroughs if you
want. Oh, yeah. That'd be fun.
There you go. That'd be fun.
What? I don't even know what he looked like, to be honest.
I don't know if there's any photos of him.
I
don't know. Let's look that up.
He looks like an old guy from the 1930s.
That does not narrow it down.
No, I'm just saying, like, he's got that, like, that kind of J.R.R. Tolkien, C.S. Lewis kind of look, like, very...
Yeah. No, he looks like William Burroughs. Is that William Burroughs' father?
That I don't know.
Let's look that up.
If you guys could talk to animals, what would you do with that skill?
Fuck around with people. I don't know.
I love
spy.
Do what?
Realistically, I would spy. Because the thing is you gotta figure, like, I would befriend, like, I would, it wouldn't even be befriend. Like, I would just be like, I'm gonna be this butler for this rich dude, and then I'm like, hey, yo, what's the fucking safe key? Like, I would just use all of their animals' knowledge against them, and then I would Robin Hood that shit.
Interesting.
I would take all the money from the fucker riches, and then I would give it to the poor.
Interesting. I like that. Brandon, what would you do if you could talk to animals?
Find out what they want whenever they're whining at me.
What the fuck do you want?
What do you want?
Yeah, let me tell you, I have parrots. It does not help because a lot of the times what they want, they can't have.
I'm just thinking about that scene from Rick and Morty where Snowball gets the robot suit attached to him.
Oh, God.
Where are my testicles, Summer? Where are my testicles?
How much would it suck to find out that, like, your animal doesn't actually like you?
That wouldn't surprise me.
It would make it easier for me to get rid of them at that point. It's like, oh, you don't want to be around here? You can go to that shelter,
right.
Little shit.
Oh, Jesse!
Wow, hey, that mean, got fucking
dude.
Dark.
This.
Hey, if they don't want to be around me, then fine.
True.
You realize they kill them sometimes.
No, don't send them to, like, a kill shelter. Send them to, like, a place where they can survive.
Rehome.
I just want to hear you backpedal now.
Yeah, rehome them.
Also, the idea that now that I have infinitely more people to be socially anxious around. What if their dog doesn't like me? Well, he'll just lick you. No, he can talk to me. if I could talk to animals, I would make just animal movies, but like as a actual like director to the animals, so you wouldn't have to have you know, the trainers and kind of stuff. You'd get exactly the animal performance you want all the time, and then I would be heralded as like one of the best animal directors of all time. It's almost like I could speak to the animals.
That's probably why they made most of the animals CGI anyways, because working with animals is one of the four taboo elements of working on
film.
Yeah, the rules of filmmaking are don't work with kids, animals, on the water, or in the snow. Kids are unpredictable. Animals, you got to train. Water is dangerous and unpredictable, and snow, you can't maintain the color temperature. Mm.
God, that's one beef that I had with the film in the that I really wanted to go into in the negative section. I hate, like, animals can do so many cool fucking things just based on the fact that they're animals and have different skills. Why did you have to rely on all of these unnatural things that animals don't do when you could use, like, a bloodhound's super nose or a bat's echolocation? Why is that? Why?
Because you're assuming that they wanted to put thought behind this script.
They didn't.
Yeah. You're thinking too hard about this.
You've thought harder about this movie in the last 2 hours than I think at any point anyone did beyond the editors.
Yeah. When did the production of this actually really begin? Was it like right after Infinity War?
Yeah, it was like May 2018 apparently.
Yeah.
Wow.
Makes sense.
Wow.
With reshoots in April of last year.
Oh my God.
For 3 weeks.
I could shoot a movie in 3 weeks. What the fuck? That's wild.
I think we've sucked the life out of this thing.
Yes. Doolittle, bad. Aaron's pitch, very good.
Yes.
Thank you. That's my first pitch.
No, you did the Matrix.
Well, you did the Matrix.
I didn't pitch that. Devin pitched that. Devin pitched Matrix. I added to it, but Devin was the one who had the primary pitch.
Interesting.
That's my first pitch.
Well, there you go.
I am normally better at like making other people's stuff better than making like my own stuff from scratch. So a lot of times I just help.
Hey, I mean, Doolittle by way of Warhorse, not a bad way to go for sure. I'd enjoy this very much.
It's not the pitch any of y'all expected.
No, it wasn't.
Because initially when this came up, I was going to do it and I was just going to be like, make it Johnny Depp. And then I'm going to give you pitches for great action scenes. And that was going to be it. Mm-hmm. So way better than what I was going to do.
Well, thank you.
I think it's time to do a little housekeeping and close out this episode. So our pitcher, I'll let you go first.
Hi, I am Erin Moriarty. If you want to find me on the internet, best place is to go find me on Twitter at @ErinMoriartyYT. That's also my Instagram, and you can find me on Linktree. That's just Erin Moriarty.
Perfect.
Oh, and I also have a podcast called Palette Cleanser where we discuss good movies that y'all should listen to as well.
Absolutely. That's a one where we don't have to pull our teeth out talking about good things about a movie. Brandon, how about you?
Yes, I am on Twitter at @OldPangYao. That's OldPangYao. And I am on Instagram at @B2Pictures. That's the letter B, the number two, and the word pictures.
Wunderbar. And Jesse, round us out here.
I have two separate podcasts. We have That Weird Ass Game, where we discuss weird and unusual games. The final episode of the season will be Spec Ops The Line, that will close out the season. And the other podcast we have is Split the Difference, where we take an original film and compare it to its remake. We just did The Wages of Fear versus Sorcerer. We did that a few weeks ago. And coming up soon, we are going to have The Nightmare on Elm Street, because it is spoopy season. It's Halloween, so we're doing scary movies this season. So we're going to have that coming up the next weekend for recording.
Leave it to Jesse to make the two shows that require the most homework.
Pretty much.
Accurate.
Sorry. That's why I'm wrapping up That Weird Ass Game this season, because it's like I have enough crap.
I'm like halfway through Spec Ops The Line, and I will definitely have things to say. But it's I think one of the few games that I hadn't played before we talked about it. So these are fresh takes.
Mm. Nice.
And to round all this out, obviously you're listening to Film Rescue. Depending on where you're listening to this, according to statistics, it's a 50-50 shot. You're listening on Apple iTunes, Podcast? What is that app called? I think it's just Podcast now.
It's just called Podcast app.
If you would, scroll down and leave us a review and a star rating. I can't make you give 5 stars, but hypothetically, if you were to do that, I would appreciate it. Also, you can support the show monetarily by going to patreon.com/Montressor Media. For $1, you get access to our back catalog, extended, uncut, and unreleased episodes of this show and all of our other shows that we have and any of our content as it comes out. We have some short films that'll be dropping across the next couple months. You can enjoy all of that for $1, including, I think our most recent upload is early access to our Fix of the Host with Micah from Below Freezing, and the uncut version of RoboCop 2, where we pitch our versions of satirical dark comedy commercials, which was a lot of fun. All of that is on Patreon. Supporting us is just the most helpful thing that you can do for us. Every dollar counts and helps us a ton. We have other tiers if you like us a lot and want to support. We try to call them out every few episodes during the break. Thank you guys for the ones that do support us currently. You all are wonderful. Thank you three for being on the show, and Aaron specifically for pitching. And I think that'll do it. I think that's housekeeping.
Sweet.
You've been listening to your Pitchmaster General, Seth Decker, on the Film Rescue Show. Have a good night.
Bye.
Good night.
What was the last scene you saw?
So the thing that made me be like, fuck this movie, I'm done, is when they're finally done with the king on the island and they've got the journal and then the journal is taken from him. And I'm like, are you fucking with me?
Oh, yeah, no, that was because that was once that happens, the ship gets blown up by the bad guys. And that's when the bromance scene between John Cena and Camille happens.
Yeah, I was just like, seriously? Like, I knew it was gonna happen, but it was one of those things like, okay, if they go through all of this shit on the island to get the journal, and then Captain Von Fuckface comes in and he takes the journal, I'm done, I'm over, I'm out. And then it happened, and I'm like, alright, I'm gonna watch a different movie now.